Welcome to The B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, materiality, and much more. The B-Side is a Sociocast production. For more, visit sociocast.org. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and Leslie Hinkson.
We're back!
We're back after a long hiatus.
We keep it in the B-Side on CP time.
So just a heads up, we've changed up our format from last season a bit. Each episode, we invite a guest on to talk about their work and its impact on their academic field. And then we ask them to engage in discussion on two topics of interest in current events. The first relates in some way to our guest's area of research and expertise, while the second topic, which we're calling, I know you didn't ask me, but is our op-ed section, where we ask guests to weigh in on topics, not because they're experts, but because they are intelligent people with unique perspectives. Today's guest is Adia Wingfield. Adia is a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. Her most recent book is Flatlining: Race, Work, and Healthcare in the New Economy, published by the University of California Press in 2019. Adia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we've been so excited about this. I've been hearing about this project for a while, and I've been chomping at the bit to talk to you about it.
So. That's right. You were there early on when I was talking about it.
Yeah. No, I remember that. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So before we get to your work, we asked you to pick what we're calling an A-side track for this episode's intro, which we came in on. What did you pick, Adia, and why?
I picked Juice by Lizzo because I am a huge, huge fan of her work. I think she's amazing.
Yeah. Well, you won't have any argument for me on that.
None. Have you seen Hustlers yet? She's in it.
I know she's in it. I haven't seen it yet.
It's actually super awesome, not to get off topic too quick out the gate, but it's super awesome and she's super awesome in it. So
great.
Yay, we love Lizzo.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So after that fabulous pick, I'm hoping for a fabulous interview with you, Adia. So why don't we just get right into it?
Okay.
Let's start talking about flatlining. Why this topic? I mean, I know for me, I think it's such a timely topic, actually, especially considering the explosion in the number of diversity, equity, and inclusion experts now.
Right.
I think that this is an amazing project, not just in terms of why, you know, this whole D&I field might be exploding. And I think that the particular experiences of the professionals that you highlight in here actually show us why we might need D&I experts who are actually experts. But it does, I think, do a great job of sort of illustrating for the reader what those particular experiences are. So why don't you tell us about your project?
Sure. So interestingly, I didn't start the research thinking I was going to focus on diversity explicitly as much as I do in the book. I really wanted to think a lot more about the bigger structural and cultural changes that are happening to work and what those mean for Black professionals. So I had done a decent amount of work previously where most of my projects have focused on questions related to Black professionals in different occupations and what those experiences look like. So I'd done some research on Black men in nursing to study their occupational mobility, some other research on Black professional men in male-dominated occupations to get a sense of how intersections of race and gender had an impact on them. But I wanted to think on a bigger level about how changes to how we work were having a larger structural impact on not only the ways in which people work, but what that meant for Black professionals. So for example, we know that we have kind of this idealized vision of what work used to look like, that people used to work in jobs where they had a lot of job security and could work with one company for the duration of their career and retire comfortably with benefits and so forth. And that model is pretty much gone. People don't work that way anymore for a variety of reasons, some of which have to do with changes to our economy and changes to the types of organizational priorities that are present today. But at the same time, a lot of organizations now do talk more about wanting to become more racially diverse than they were in the past and wanting to attract more workers of color and appeal more to communities of color. And I was interested in what I saw as kind of a dichotomy or a tension between those two imperatives, that And as much as we've seen organizations shifting their focus to say that they do want to have more racial diversity, they're also saying this at a time when the economy has changed and the pathways into professional work have become a lot less certain, and where professional work itself and work overall has become a lot less stable. So Black professionals now have these opportunities, at least on paper, to move into these jobs at a time when access to those jobs and the jobs themselves have become a lot more insecure. And I was really fascinated by that paradox and thinking about what that meant for Black workers on an everyday basis as they try to navigate work and being in these environments where finally now you have access, again, on paper, to these professional jobs. But what does that access really mean? And what does that look like if the avenues to getting to that work have become so much more uncertain than they have in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I could totally see how, given, you know, what I thought was sort of like a great explanation of your project and, you know, sort of what motivated it, I could see it focusing not on healthcare workers, but on the Obama presidency, right? I mean, yeah. On paper, right? Yeah. You have access, right? And the sort of crazy confluence of the economy tanking, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and also I think a very, very weird moment in this country's history in the ways in which we think about race, mm-hmm. right? And inclusion, And the ways in which, yeah, even though we say we want it, right, we don't know how much we want it.
Right.
And what are the things that we have done to ensure that this African-American male can actually succeed in the highest office without actually thinking explicitly about how, you know, sort of the how there are these structural forces that might work against his success.
Right. Right, right. Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up Obama because I've thought a lot about his presidency over the 8 years he was in office, and certainly with very different feelings over the last 3 years that he's not been in office. But I've thought about it a lot in this context of him really being an exemplar of many ways that Black professional workers in predominantly white environments have to navigate those settings, the emotional contexts that are present. And we hear a lot of, or heard a lot of discussion, for example, about Obama always being this even-keeled person and maintaining this certain temperament. And I don't know him, but by all accounts, that seemed to be somewhat consistent with who he was as a person. But it also raises this question of if he weren't that type of person, would he still have the emotional available leeway to get angry, to get frustrated, to be mad in a public setting? Could he have a press conference where he appears totally unhinged and rant about people being treasonous spies? I feel like probably not. I feel probably like there would be consequences for Obama as the first Black president engaging in those types of emotional histrionics in ways that don't seem to be applicable for other people holding that office, in ways that I think are not just a result of political polarization, but also do tie back to the racial categorizations that are present and the ways in which those have implications for emotional availability and performance. And I think your point about the structures that are present go to that as well, right? That we have this person who was able to mobilize based on very unique conditions. And I think it's important to keep that in mind also, that Obama ran for office at a time when the numbers of populations of color in the country had reached a certain critical mass that afforded him the election in the first place. Most whites voted for McCain in 2008 and voted for Mitt Romney in 2012. So that's an important factor to keep in mind, that he won election because he was able to mobilize extraordinarily high turnouts of people of color during that time period. But he also won election, at least the first time, in part because of record at that time dissatisfaction with the incumbent and economic collapse and just crazy levels of things falling apart during the time period where he was running. So it is useful, as you mentioned, to think about the sorts of structural issues or what some sociologists refer to as that glass cliff phenomenon, where when everything is falling apart, then that's when people of color and women of all races get opportunities to go in and fix things once they've already been brought to the brink of destruction. And those are all aspects of the types of structural challenges that are present for Black professionals who aren't in the presidency, but are working in everyday environments.
Building off of that, one of the things that sort of interesting about that point is that it's a little bit about the way Black professionals do the job. Like, so it's like a Black professional has to do it one way, whereas like a white professional can get away with doing it any old kind of way. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I thought was really interesting about the project is the way you talk about, it's not just how you do the job, but also what you're doing in terms of the content of the job seems to be looking different for Black professionals, you know, who have the same job title, right? Like, so you come into the office, like you're both, you know, resident, but the Black resident has a whole different set of responsibilities. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the content of work is different for Black professionals and shifting.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things I was happy I was able to highlight with this project, because I think in a lot of our research on race and work, we talk a lot about what is done to Black professionals in terms of discrimination and marginalization and stunted opportunities for mentorship and things like that. I don't think we necessarily talk as much about what Black professionals are doing to and in their workplaces. And this project, in focusing on Black healthcare workers, really gave me a chance to highlight what that looks like and gave me a chance to highlight how that looks different depending on the occupational position that Black workers are employed in. So to your point, one of the things that I try to stress in the book is that for Black healthcare workers across the board, they inhabit these environments where race matters in their work. But how they see race mattering occurs very differently depending on their occupational position. But how they see it mattering also impacts the things that they do to try to change their workplaces and make them more equitable spaces. What I refer to in the book as the equity work of trying to improve organizations to make them more palatable and accessible to communities of color. So for Black doctors, because in the healthcare hierarchy, they are unquestionably at the top. They're the people who are in the highest status positions in the healthcare hierarchy. They're very comfortable with that. They're comfortable letting you know that and letting other people know that. But that also gives them access to a certain level of resources and opportunities that aren't necessarily available for nurses and technicians. So for Black doctors, I found that they would go to work and be responsible for the kind of baseline things that are part of being a doctor, treating patients and dealing with insurance companies and so forth. But they also did an additional layer of work in terms of trying to make sure that they were addressing some of the structural causes that could lead to not only Black patients facing adverse treatment, but that minimize the numbers of Black workers in the physician profession in the first place. So Black doctors did an inordinate, amazing amount of mentoring, of seeking out and being responsive to and reaching out to potential physicians who were Black who were interested in the profession. This is particularly important when we think about the context of the new economy, where work and advancement matters significantly, or is driven significantly by access to relationships and mentors and people who can vouch for you and who can give you a heads up or information about potential jobs and ways in which you might be suitable for advancement into certain positions that you otherwise might not know about. So Black doctors were really focused on that sort of thing, as well as doing work outside of the hospitals to make sure that they could try to reduce health disparities for communities of color, setting up clinics and things like that. Black nurses also were really focused on doing work to improve the communities or the organizations where they were employed. But because they were in a different position relative to doctors, they didn't necessarily have the same status and resources that that offered. So for them, they focused much more on doing this in the context of being change agents. They talked a lot about wanting to make sure that they were really strong and fierce advocates, particularly for patients of color, because by virtue of their work, they saw a lot of ways that patients of color are mistreated in the healthcare system and the ways in which they're disbelieved and shunned and not giving adequate pain medication, all the things that we know happen to Black patients in these types of settings. Technicians had probably the least status relative to doctors and nurses in the hospital structure. And what that meant was that they were saddled with doing what I refer to again as this equity work in more explicit fashion. There were cases where managers would explicitly assign them work that wasn't assigned to their white counterparts, but they also engaged in equity work of trying to make organizational settings better for patients of color again by making sure that they could advocate for them when possible and leveraging their cultural capital if they had more of a relationship or an understanding of what patients of color might have wanted or needed, and trying to bring that to the attention of nurses who were directly above them in the occupational structure. So this is kind of a lengthy answer, but I bring all this up because I think it's important for thinking and talking more about how Black workers, professionals at different levels of the organizational structure, are really actively involved in trying to make these workplaces, environments, and settings that are more welcoming and more diverse and more inclusive. And the key thing to me about this is that they are doing all of this work on top of their actual jobs right. that they need to do, right? This is a whole additional level of labor, of work, of intensity that gets done. And it gets done for the betterment of the organization, but often without organizational resources, support, and in some cases, even recognition. And I think that's the really vexing part of this issue, is that you have these organizations that are benefiting in very particular ways from Black labor that aren't acknowledging or recognizing that that labor is happening.
So I have a question. I don't know if it's a fair question to ask, but I'm just wondering because, I mean, in our work and also the work of others, and also in our life experiences, I think that we can actually say that it's not always the case mm-hmm. that you have Black workers within an organization who seem to take on this extra work mm-hmm. in the ways that, for in particular, the doctors seem to be taking on this work. This is part of our mission. You know, we're here to mentor, and even if we don't get compensated for it, you know, this is something that we're committed to doing. Is there something special about the healthcare field that, you know, seems to inspire this kind of, you know, sort of commitment to this work from Black workers?
That's a good question. I think, to some degree, healthcare might be, I don't know if I want to say unique, but I think you're right to frame it in terms of what might there be about healthcare that would make Black healthcare professionals have this orientation. And I think some of it does have to do with healthcare and the motivations that many healthcare professionals shared with me for getting into healthcare in the first place. This is a profession where most people that I spoke to came into this type of work because they do care about healing and patients and making life better for people. So in that sense, it's an occupation that's motivated for many Black professionals that I spoke with, and some white professionals as well, a profession that's motivated by this altruistic idea of wanting to create improvement and opportunity and to help people be better. I think that has racialized implications, though, that are manifest in the ways in which Black workers do this equity work. Because I think for many Black professionals, this motivation to want to care for people and help them to be better is often overlaid with this understanding that for Black patients, there are additional challenges and problems that make it very difficult for them to experience care, but to be treated in a respectful, humane fashion. And that there are a lot of structural problems that add to complications leading to worse health outcomes for them in the first place. So I think that there are some professions where we might be likely to see some replication of this. If those professions are ones that have a similar orientation, I'm thinking about education, for example, might be mm-hmm. a similar type of field, but you might be less likely to see this in professions that don't have that same orientation. So for example, if we went into the financial industry where the motivation is primarily about profit because that's how it's designed, you might be less likely to see people who have the same focus on wanting to improve organizations for communities of color. And I'm speculating to some degree. I don't know that because I haven't done research asking mm-hmm. that specific question.
I mean, so like some of my stuff, my new project is looking at Black people who work in advertising. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is the extent, and I think about this a lot, and I'm super excited that your book is out because in some ways it's helping me process what I'm seeing. Because what's interesting is like you will get very similar rhetoric around like I'm doing this equity work or sort of like diversity work for this imagined audience of minorities who, you know, need a voice and like, you know, they need to be represented. And mm-hmm. so I could totally imagine finance people being like, well, no, this is actually about my work is actually about giving, you know, access to these financial tools to audiences who don't normally get it. Mm-hmm. And there is, and it's interesting because I think about this in relation to your project, because it's like, in some ways, the narrative, I think because of the context in which the work is happening, come off, I mean, in some, for lack of a better word, more sympathetic. It's like, I feel for these Black professionals in the healthcare, because it's like, no, you're absolutely right. And like, you know, and you are getting these people healthcare. But my response to it, when it's like, you hear financial professionals talking about like, no, we're trying to get affordable loans to Black people. And it's like, well, but affordable means exploitive, really. And like, you're the agent of that. And so it's like, it's interesting to think about how this sort of rhetoric gets deployed in both cases, but the context in which that work is happening, it has really different implications. I mean, certainly for the actual recipients of the service, right?
Yeah.
But also, it's interesting to think about like the organizational implications as well, right? Because I mean, that's what sort of the fascinating thing about your project is, like, it's employees, but it's also employees interacting with institutions, like mm-hmm. organizations, right? And right. I would have to guess that, like, the organizational demand also operates as drive for these things. So on the one hand, it's definitely like individual employees who are like, oh, I want the world to be better for Black folks, so like I'm gonna, you know, help make it better for Black folks. But I also imagine these medical facilities are like, well, our patients and / customers are increasingly non-white folks, and we want to cater to the audience in a way that's like, you know, appealing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, so I guess to what extent are like the organizations, the employers, right, sensitive to this or aware of this? And I don't know, for lack of a better word, again, taking advantage?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if that's mm-hmm. the right word.
Well, I think that's fair to say, at least from the perspective of many of my respondents who did feel okay. as though they were, that they and their work and their commitments were being taken advantage of. And I talk about this, I think, the most specifically in the chapter in the book that deals with workers in the public sector. And I really wanted to think about that as an interesting case, because we know that we've seen the public sector shrink enormously over the last, I'd say about 30 to 40 years or so. Mm-hmm. And that's occurred due to a variety of factors, but that's had severe and significant consequences for Black workers, because historically, the public sector was the area that was relatively safer and more prosperous in terms of access to work and maintaining gainful, steady, middle-class employment. And that had to do with the public sector desegregating before the private sector did, and rules that made public sector work more stable for Black workers. So we know previous research before mine has shown that as the public sector has become increasingly privatized, that has had consequences for Black workers, particularly Black men, in terms of creating more economic insecurity and more uncertainty and instability. So I really wanted to think about what that meant for Black healthcare workers who might go into public sector work and be employed in public hospitals, and how those changes and the insecurity of the public sector had an impact on them. And one of the things that I found that I talk about in this chapter that I thought was really interesting is that the insecurity of the public sector did not necessarily stop Black workers from seeking out that sector. There were a lot of Black workers that I talked to who knew that they could make a lot more in the private sector and in private employment, but intentionally and specifically chose the public sector because they were motivated by this idea of wanting to provide fair, equitable, respectful healthcare to communities of color, who are those that are predominantly served by these public facilities, and that mattered to them and that that was important. The downside came, though, to your point, when many of these workers felt that the organizations where they worked relied on that commitment and relied on their focus and devotion to communities of color in ways that seemed exploitive and marginalizing and unfair. So there's a point in the chapter on the public sector in chapter 5 where I recount an exchange that I had with a doctor, a Black woman doctor at the public sector the public sector hospital where I spent some time. And she was really forceful and evocative about how frustrating she found that aspect of her work. And she described herself as saying that it made her feel like mammy to see how the organization just used and took advantage of Black women's empathy. And she told me that there's no one in medicine as a group that has more empathy than Black women. They see and they care and they want to make things better and they want to improve. And she told me that there was no doubt in her mind that management was aware of that. And given that they worked in this under-resourced area, that they did not often have all the tools and the things that they needed in order to offer the types of care that they wanted to, management figured that they could make do by just expecting Black workers and Black women workers in particular to engage in the work that was necessary to make up the difference. And that does take a toll on workers in the public sector who do experience a lot of frustration, a lot of stress, and I think maybe significantly experience a real sense of disillusionment and distance from the organizations where they work, because it's hard to feel committed to a place that you feel like is using you and that is exploiting you. And that is how many Black public sector workers described the kind of contradictory feelings that they had about their employment. They went into this work because they wanted to, and they wanted to make a difference, and they wanted to care for populations that they knew would often be ignored. But they also recognized that they were doing so against enormous headwinds, and that they felt resentful about the ways that organizations took advantage of that.
It's interesting because I think, like, you know, this sort of public-private sector distinction, and when this is happening in Black professionals, becomes really important because, like, I think, you know, if you could think about this playing out in private sector context, if you're being sort of richly compensated for this work that you're doing, it actually might end up changing your relationship, not to your employer, but to the people you're supposedly serving, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting to think about because, like, being forced into this work in either context, doing this extra stuff, like, it is labor, it is work, it takes a toll. And on the one hand, it'll affect how you feel about your employer, but it has to wrap back around and start to affect how you feel about the people. Mm-hmm. Like, and so it's interesting because you could imagine that this kind of racial empathy, I don't want to say a finite resource, but it's not an endless resource, and that by taking advantage of it, employers are also actually eroding it.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of what we've just been discussing, you know, in the last few minutes, like, I think brings us back to what I think is a very useful concept that you employ here, that you created here, racial outsourcing, right? Yes. And so I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that concept and also the ways in which we can use that concept beyond, you know, your case study.
Yeah, sure. So I thought of this concept as a way of illustrating what I saw as a gap between what organizations say that they want and what actually happens. So most of my respondents worked in organizations that on paper, or if you ask them publicly or look at their website or whatever, would say that they have a commitment to racial diversity and that that's very important to them and that that's something that they strongly believe in. And to be in compliance with legal standards, organizations cannot today openly and publicly say that they discriminate. That's illegal, and you can get into trouble if you openly acknowledge doing that. So organizations, I think for the most part, and many of the respondents that I talked with worked at organizations that did this, would say that they believed in diversity and that that mattered and they were committed to creating a diverse workforce. But then you have to think about what actually happens in practice. And this is where I found a mismatch. And many of my respondents would argue that while the organizations where they worked would say that they were committed to racial diversity, there was a gap between what they said and what actually happened in practice. And what actually happened in practice ranged from either kind of boilerplate statements and nothing else to measures that were not tailored to and did not address the types of challenges that Black workers felt that they actually experienced in the workplace. Given this gap that occurred, organizations did not necessarily always put resources into creating programming or initiatives or resources or what have you to creating more equitable environments for Black workers. Instead, they kind of tacitly left that work up to Black professionals. And so that was what I refer to as this idea of racial outsourcing, that when organizations say that they want to have more racial diversity, but then don't put the resources, support, programming, effort actually behind actually creating it, but leave it up to Black professionals to do this work, this becomes a process of racial outsourcing where they shift this work onto people who are workers in the organizational setting. Often that work I found falls to Black professionals who then do what I refer to as the equity work of having to do the things that I was talking about earlier, establish the informal off-the-books mentoring programs, put together the community outreach activities, serve as change agents to be fierce patient advocates for patients of color, leveraging their cultural capital to make sure that they are making sure that patients' wishes and needs and desires are actually understood by the staff who are treating them. As I mentioned before, the big conundrum of this type of work is that when racial outsourcing happens and equity work is the result, this is work that exists outside of the bounds of and apart from the actual labor that workers of color are being paid to do. So you have them doing the work of being a doctor, a nurse, a technician, or what have you, but you also have them doing this added level of equity work on top of that, which again, I want to stress, serves the organization's purpose enormously. This is very beneficial to organizations to have Black workers doing this labor. They are doing the groundwork and the actual legwork of making sure that organizations, to the best that they can, are servicing patients of color and communities of color in ways that are somewhat effective. But what you have are individuals who are trying to solve a structural problem. These are not issues that can be solved by a few individuals sprinkled throughout an organization, dramatically transforming organizational processes. These are not things that these workers can do on their own. And with organizations kind of tacitly engaging in this project or this process where they say that they have these missions, they say that they want to see this enacted, they don't put resources behind it, they leave it up to the few workers of color in their employ to do it, then what you have is a modern incarnation of a certain type of racial inequality that lands on Black professional workers and results in, once again, a model of them doing more work that they are not paid for doing while still operating in ways that serve the organization's benefit but allow the organizations to overlook or sidestep that labor.
I think you could argue that organizations are also implicitly taking advantage of structural racial inequalities, right? Yeah. Because it's certainly the case that I'm sure organizations would be like, oh, well, I mean, I see this in my stuff. Like if you work at like an all Black place, it's like, yeah, you are doing the same accounting job, right, at this Black firm, but like you're not having to do the same sort of equity work.
Right.
But because it's an all Black firm, it's bound by like the pay is going to be lower yep. because like getting bigger clients is more difficult. Like there are all these like sort of structural things that mm-hmm. make that less sort of appealing work. And so if you go work at, you know, Price Coopers, well, now you're the Black guy mm-hmm. or the Black lady. So you're doing that work, but you're also an accountant and you have to do all that work. But you probably do make a little bit more vis-a-vis the person who works at the all Black mm-hmm. accounting firm just because white people, the baseline salary at the white workplace is higher,
right.
but you're still making less than your white coworker, right. arguably, and doing more work. And so, I don't know, I mean, now you got me all worked up. I mean, it's certainly, you can think about it as like taking advantage of like those workers for sure, but also taking advantage of like systemic inequalities, right? right? Mm-hmm. That like put these workers in a bind. Mm-hmm. And you sort of are left with like, well, what choice do you have,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's definitely, it's screwy because it's like, it happens across, that's what's so crazy, it happens across institutions and like right. public sector things that, you know, if you're looking at private medical practices too, I'm sure, and certainly in, you know, the corporate world, when you look at
and let's not forget academia.
Absolutely.
let's not forget, quiet as it's kept.
Where's my tea? I need to sit on it.
So, just saying.
My mic's going out.
We need not sure. go there.
I mean, it's strongly implied. What some of the interventions may be to deal with some of this look like, right? Because I have a hard time imagining employers being like, okay, well, could they directly say, we're going to pay you extra for this Black work? Because the white folks at work are going to go crazy if that's the case. But is there a way to sort of either compensate for this work or maybe more reasonably decrease it, have the institution take over?
Yes, I actually think that in our current structure, I think that the latter solution is actually very workable. And the thing that I think is the optimistic part of this research is that it does provide a blueprint for what I think organizations can be doing to make these changes. The problem is that organizations are not doing this. They are leaving it up to Black professional workers to do this work. But as I mentioned before, this shouldn't be the responsibility of a few individuals sprinkled throughout an organization, right? But if you think about the example that I gave of Black doctors who were engaging in this informal mentoring that cuts into, again, the limited amount of time that they have to do all of their other work as well, and who are engaging in putting together these community organizations or community fairs that are devoted to reducing racial health disparities. What if instead of that being the job of the lone Black pediatrician or the lone Black emergency medicine doctor in an organization, right. the organization took on that responsibility and instituted a formal mentoring program that explicitly made sure that interested students of color had matches with people who were physicians who could give them the guidance and the structure and the information and the background knowledge about what it takes to succeed and do effective work in medicine. What if hospitals and organizations actually structured community fairs and organizations and put resources and effort behind making sure that they did outreach designed to reduce racial health disparities? Those are things that workers are doing that organizations can be doing. And of course, I'm not suggesting that there are no organizations that are doing these types of things. But I think that if you think about how these things could occur on a grand scale with organizational resources behind them, what that would mean if organizations took on this focus of trying to address these racial disparities and these issues, you can see how that can go a lot further than expecting one or two individuals within this organization to get these problems solved. And I think that particularly in the, I was thinking about your point about linking this back to structural issues and questions, because that matters a lot as well for a couple of ways. One, if we're thinking about the structural dynamics that are present here, organizations, I think, have been subject to many of the same types of neoliberal arguments and ideologies that have shaped a lot of our public policy over the last 30 or 40 years, which I think is part of why these types of initiatives and efforts haven't gotten the support that perhaps that I personally think that they should have. Organizational policy is focused much more on maximizing profit and maximizing returns for those who are at the top. But if we think about where our society is heading and the ways in which we're becoming an increasingly multiracial and predominantly comprised of people of a society that's going to be largely comprised of people of color, this is a strategic and advantageous moment for organizations to make a choice that actually better serves them in the long run. Your customer base, your patient base, your workers are going to be increasingly multiracial in the next 20, 30, 40 years. Do you want to really be an organization that isn't motivated or that isn't equipped to solve the issues of the workers who are going to be your workforce? That's, in my opinion, not a sustainable long-term path. And so I think it's incumbent on organizations to start wrestling with and thinking about the fact that as your workforce is going to become increasingly racially diverse, as the people that you serve, your consumer base, is going to become increasingly racially diverse, it's to your benefit to think about how to incorporate your mission and your resources and your goals in ways that reflect the needs of the populations that you're going to be serving and how that population is going to be changing over time. And organizations that do that, I think, are going to be a lot more equipped for and better prepared to handle where our future is going than the organizations that simply leave it up to a few individuals to try to offer structural solutions from an individual perspective.
Now to our first topic of conversation, the decision in the Students for Fair Admissions v. Harvard case. So in a 130-page decision, Judge Allison Burroughs ruled in favor of Harvard University. So the plaintiffs contended that the admissions process was biased against Asian and Asian American students, arguing in part that Blacks and Hispanics were favored in the process at the expense of Asian and Asian American applicants. And I thought that given the fact that all three of us are expert in some way in terms of, you know, sort of the use of or the meaning of race, either in organizations or, you know, blow it up institutions, I thought that this would actually be a great topic of conversation for us to engage in.
Okay, so, well, I think just transitioning off of our conversation about Black professionals, this is, I guess, slightly orthogonal to the case, but what is always striking to me in these conversations about diversity on college campuses and inclusion and stuff is how, you know, the narrative, I get it, legally is always framed around, like, it's not about, you know, paying Black folks back for treating them like shit decades ago. It's actually about like creating opportunities for diverse learning and getting insights and everybody grows and expands, which in effect just actually turns the Black students into laborers in the diversity yes. projects of universities, which is so fascinating to think coming off talking about flatlining. So it's like we're pre-training them for the work that they're going to have to do once they get these college degrees and go into these organizations and operate in the same sort of way. And so, I mean, so right. So yes, the good decision. Yes. Yay. You know, like obviously it, from my perspective is that, you know, the whole thing was just like part of this concerted effort to erode the opportunity structure for non-white students at these elite places. But it's also interesting to think that like the only way to save it is to be like, no, like we need this whole pool of laborers to make college more experiential for, you know, some kid from, you know, Connecticut or Vermont. You know?
And you know, what I find so fascinating is yet again, the framing of this issue around the small piece of pie that that students of color have, right? Rather than being like, oh, hey, you know, we actually believe we have ample evidence that Asian and Asian American students are being put to a higher standard than white students, right? I mean, that just seemed quite obvious to me. So why constantly go back to the relatively small number of Black and Latino students?
Well, an ironic thing that I have been thinking about with this is that it's interesting that these affirmative action cases keep getting pushed by this one attorney.
Yes.
Because I think he actually should be a proponent of affirmative action. And the reason I say that is that he has repeatedly sought out opportunities to sue and advance this cause. And most of them have not gotten the result that he wanted. But yet he still gets opportunity after opportunity to try to do something that he hasn't succeeded in doing. And that might itself be of how affirmative action operates for certain groups. I don't think that most people of color get access to jobs where they can continually fail in their objectives and get chance after chance to keep trying to do that job. But I think that's what's happening in his case, that he's tried to advance a certain objective repeatedly, hasn't done so successfully, and yet continues to look for opportunity after opportunity to do so. That in itself might be a function of a certain type of affirmative action. I think that's an interesting.
I love it. Blum? He's like the biggest beneficiary of affirmative action.
Exactly. He should be on the board.
No, that's
counting its benefits. Like, this whole thing is winning for me. Affirmative action rocks. I'm getting a chance to keep trying over and over again, unsuccessfully.
I mean, it is interesting to think about, like, I don't know, how little substantive movement has actually happened on the issue in terms of like change in policies, yet the sort of rhetorical juice that it sort of manages to carry has actually like high and relatively constant, probably, I mean, you know, maybe even trending upwards. And it just feels like on some level, this is really mostly just about the having the conversation around it, because it can't possibly be about the actual butts and seats. Like, right, the numbers are, it's like, and the people who are most passionate about this issue, oftentimes I find are like, you have not been on an elite college campus in a long time. Like, what you're saying to me is indicative of how little you know about like who is going to be schools and like, who is taking up seats, you know? And so it just definitely feels like we've survived this cycle, but it's like, now it's going to be next. The North Carolina, it's going to circle back again. And everything comes back to your work. It's like now the emotional labor of all like sort of like non-white people in academia and white allies, right, I guess, is going to have to be mobilized yet again, you know, to deal with this. And it's like, we got books and articles to write, like, you know.
Well, I think this shows, okay, I guess affirmative action gets to live and fight another day. But I mean, part of me thinks that,
oh, is it affirmative action that gets to live and fight? Or is it like,
no, it's affirmative action. Affirmative action gets to live and fight another day.
Okay, so they can't, you can't call it that. I mean, but I thought you couldn't call it that. Well, anyway, sorry.
You can't call it quotas, but you can call it affirmative action, right?
Okay.
So I'm hoping that what this case is showing us is that, number one, they're going to appeal and try and bring it to the Supreme Court, which, you know, in its current configuration actually means that affirmative action may not be living for much longer. It's number one, but also number two, I think that it should prompt all of us who actually care about representation on a college and university campuses to actually do the labor to try and reimagine and reconfigure what affirmative action looks like. And also the conversation around affirmative action. I'm always blown away by the ways in which people think affirmative action works, right? And who it works for. And I think that, you know, in some ways, I think colleges and universities have a vested interest in allowing that sort of narrative to continue, right? We are these beneficent individuals and we give these people who otherwise wouldn't have a shot, et cetera, right? And I think we need to turn that around. Although I will say that the cost of recreating that narrative might mean that students of color may no longer feel as though they need to be engaging in the diversity labor anymore.
Well, so. It'll be in keeping with my statements before about how demographics are changing. It will be interesting in about 20 or 30 years when people of color numerically represent the majority, to see what the discourse around affirmative action is. It'll be interesting to see how the conversations get framed around who deserves to have access based on numerical representation.
And I guess one like last thing on this, I mean, the contribution to the conversation around these issues, I think this case in particular has certainly brought to light more talking and more thinking about variation among people in the category of Asian American. And so you have to think about Jennifer Lee and Van Tran, shout out to their work. But just like, I think this whole conversation, and actually, you know, not just variation among Asian Americans, but also like the POC label and like sort of thinking through some of those categorizations. So, you know, there's good that's come out of it for sure.
Okay. B-side listeners, this is our newest segment that we are calling, I know you didn't ask me, but it is, I guess, our version of an op-ed section. And the reason why we're introducing it is because there seems to be some opinions out there in the world of academia that academics can only talk about exactly what it is they research, right? However, we believe that academics, through our training and also the fact that we survived graduate school, actually have a very unique perspective on topics outside of their areas of expertise. So we're not claiming we're experts in this, but we want to have a discussion.
This is kind of like hot off the presses. Yesterday, the Dallas former police officer who shot and killed her Black neighbor, Botham Jean, the officer's name was Amber, Geiger is the pronunciation of the last name. I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
But so, you know, we've heard a lot about the story when it happened, right? She walked up into his apartment and shot him and was all like, oh, I was so tired. I thought it was mine. Well, the jury didn't buy that. She was convicted. And then the sentencing came down yesterday. Well, she got a grand total of 10 years. And I think there's a larger conversation to be had about disparities in sentencing and how long we should be locking people up and how to balance not wanting to lock people up for a long time, but also getting justice for Black folks getting shot. But what I really want to talk about is what's gotten picked up is in the sentencing process, Jean's family members, his brother, I think his mom, and I think his dad as well, all spoke. It sort of talked about the forgiveness they were extending to Geiger, right? And then I guess at the end, the judge even hugged her. You know, now the sort of day after coverage is all like, look at this forgiveness. And like, this is a model. And, you know, you have high profile people on Twitter tweeting, this is America's not broken, even though it seems like. It because of Trump stuff. And again, it's perfect timing because I think it does come back to something we were talking about earlier with this notion of like doing this sort of diversity and inclusion work and the disproportionate responsibility that falls on Black people to do it. And so, and you know, like I can't speak to how the family is processing their own feelings around the loss of their son and brother. You know, forgiveness, it's not even about the person. It's a lot about the people. So, hey, they're certainly free to do what they want to do. But I think this notion that somehow that should be some sort of model or sort of an admirable, that's a good way to do it or the good way to experience it seems quite troubling. And I have to say, just like officially, it seems all kind of out of whack for the judge to be
hugging a convicted murderer in her courtroom.
Right. And again, this is so troubling because it's like, I don't want to be like, judges have to be robots and can never show you. Like, that's not what I'm saying either. But it feels like there was a line crossed. And if you want me to go back and demarcate where that line is, I'd be happy to in this case, because it really feels like that was doing too much. But what do you guys think?
I mean, this will be somewhat self-evident, I guess, but I just suppose that it's hard to imagine reversing those roles and seeing the same outcome. It's hard for me to imagine a Black man convicted of murder and convicted of murdering a white woman, getting hugged by a white woman judge, and the performance of forgiveness and sympathy and empathy happening in that way. I just feel like that seems unlikely and unrealistic. I mean, we had a case recently where the, I'm forgetting his name, but the police officer in Minneapolis shot Justine Diamond, I think. I might be messing up her name, but I don't remember accounts of him being hugged after his conviction.
Exactly.
Right.
Or outpouring of sympathy for him after that happened. And I wasn't there, but I don't remember reading about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two things. I mean, I think, you know, particularly the performance of the judge, like I kind of feel like there is this presumption that like, yes, this, we all believe that this was an accident and it was a tragic accident. And we are sorry for you that you have to live with this for the rest of your life, right? Whereas, you know, a young man no longer has a life, right? Because of your tragic accident. That's number one. Number two, I will say, I mean, so the Jean family comes from the same island that my family's from. They are a very religious family as well. I think that that sort of their level of religiosity and faith, I think, is partly, you know, what explains particularly his brother, you know, saying, I forgive you and I wish you didn't have to go to prison. I wish all you had to do was give your life to Jesus Christ, right? And I think that that is, we need to be able to contextualize this, that this isn't just about, you know, all Black folks saying, you know, okay, we forgive and people make mistakes, because the protesters outside were very angry about the verdict, right?
True. It could be an important lesson in the variation within Black people in response. It's like, we don't all
respond because we're not all the same.
No, I think Eric Garner's widow had a very different reaction, right? If you remember her explicitly saying she did not forgive the officer who killed her husband.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, yeah, so putting it within that context, I think, you know, makes us, I think should make us think, I think a little bit more critically about, you know, sort of what this means about Black-white relations in the United States.
And by us, I'm assuming you mean white people, because Black people obviously understand.
No, but I mean, but also,
generalize us.
Yes, right. Yes. Although I will say, I mean, I do think there's some Black folk who are looking at the verdict and also the behavior of Jean's brother and maybe not sort of understanding it. And it's like, well, you know, like he's not from this country, right?
Fair enough.
And you need to understand that we are not all the same. And particularly when we come from different cultures, right? And also too, when you bring religion into the conversation, you know, you should not be able to judge, right, that individual's experience and their reaction unless you understand where they're coming from.
What's getting left out of this conversation? The mother spoke eloquently about the need to root out corruption in the Dallas Police Department as well, but I didn't see Chris Evans, Captain America, tweeting about that, you know?
Exactly.
You know, I think, it's definitely like, Black people are complicated and we have a range of responses to stuff, but I also think there's this story around, like, what get traction and what narratives about Black people get picked up. And I don't think it's a coincidence that sort of like this narrative of like racial forgiveness as the movement forward is sort of what's getting taken up, because I imagine, a lot of people want to believe, well, if Black people could be more forgiving, then maybe we could move ahead on all this stuff, which is not it. I mean, certainly not only it.
Right. I mean, I think I agree with the point about what focusing on what gets picked up and what gets traction, because we could also be having a continued conversation about disparities in the criminal justice system.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we could have a continued conversation about policing and police violence and guns in the United States. Those are all conversations that I think we should be having and that should be continuing to be ongoing, that are at play here, right? And those would be conversations that would be useful in thinking about and talking about the bigger issues that surrounded this tragedy in the first place. Why do you have a situation where an off-duty police officer goes first to shooting somebody after making a mistake? Why aren't regular procedures followed? Why isn't first aid administered to this person that you've just shot once you realize that you've made this mistake.
Right. Exactly. Right?
I mean, these are also conversations that we can be having apart from this question of, I guess what I'm saying is, what if the effort and the energy being put into thinking about and talking about and emphasizing forgiveness was effort and energy put into thinking about and talking about police brutality and policing and the criminal justice system and disparities that happen there?
Right.
What if we talked about that? And not to even kind of go further, but what if we also talked about workplace conditions that lead people to work shifts where they are often overworked? And I am not saying that to think to minimize the tragedy of what happened and the severity of the mistake. But perhaps we should also be talking about the conditions that workers like officers face or other workers who are in those types of jobs where they are expected to work long shifts in jobs that are dangerous and that allow them to have access to firearms and weapons. What are the conditions we're putting workers in and then expecting them to live productive, reasonable lives when they may be putting people in danger as a consequence of the work environments that they're required to complete.
Right.
Exactly.
But instead, I think what's happening is, you know, now the whole thing is going to get tied up with a nice little bow of like, oh, the conviction happened. So it wasn't like a wild racial, you know, fuck up. And the family forgives her. So like, now we can just.
So what are you sociologists still complaining about?
Yeah, exactly. No harm, no foul. No harm, no foul.
It's just like, no, nothing's wrapped up. Nothing at all.
Yeah. No harm, no foul. You've been listening to The B-Side. Thanks to our guest, Adia Wingfield from Washington University in St. Louis. And we'd also like to thank our young producers at Queens College, Jaylene Colon and the Seth Marino. The B-Side is part of the growing Sociocast podcasting empire. Check out our sister programs at sociocast.org. We're your hosts,
Corey Fields
and Leslie Hinkson. And so to take us out, Corey and I actually selected a B-side pairing to go with Adia's A-side selection. Corey?
So, right, our selection was Prince, Baby I'm a Star, because we interviewed a star today and we're all stars. Lizzo's a star, everybody's a star.
Yes.
Don't forget to check us out on Twitter at B-side_podcast. You can follow to find updates of shows and cool stuff we're interested in.
Okay, and that's about it. We're out. Thanks for joining us in the relaunch of the B-Side, and I hope you'll join us next time. We're back. Okay, thanks again, Adia.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.